Welcome to the podcast, ladies and gentlemen. I'm your co-host, Morgan Wack, and I'm here with the ultra-democratic Eddie Matthews. How are you doing today, Eddie?
Hi, hello, welcome. We have all this fancy new equipment that I'm still getting used to.
I will say, for the fans out there, this is a new year. 2024 is the year of rationalish. Eddie, we had a chat, and we were going to professionalize the podcast. We bought our own microphones, and you obviously you're hearing it now, and you're like, wow, these guys are, it's like they're in the room. And I told Eddie, you know, we should probably prep a bit more. I show up to this podcast. He's got pages of notes, basically a biography on today's subject. So if this episode is better than usual, you only have one man to thank, and that man is Eddie Matthews. If it's worse, he also will take the blame. So
I'm super serious. I'm taking this super seriously, and I want everybody else to. And I put a lot of time and effort, and I'm really serious about this podcast, and I'm taking it really seriously.
If I worked with Eddie, I would be concerned because he's definitely losing out on whatever project he's working on at work for the podcast. And that's how we like it here, because our viewers are number one. The rational listeners are number one in our hearts. Eddie, what is today's episode? Episode of 2024.
We are going to make the case for increasing the amount of members of the House of Representatives of this great nation. It might be counterintuitive that the way to fix the House of Representatives is to expand it, is to have more congressmen and women, because the approval rate of Congress is always hovering around like 15%. And so that's what makes it counterintuitive, is we actually need more of them. But we'll get into all of the fun of that in a minute. What attracted you to this topic?
I love politicians. I just want more of them so I can geek out. Just bring them on. Just, you know, men politicians, women politicians, animals in Congress. You know, I'm all for it.
Isn't that the funny part of this whole dilemma, is that politicians tend to be the most like insufferable people, but part of what makes them insufferable is a systemic issue that forces this type of behavior, and that actually creating more of them would decrease the amount of insufferability.
It's a great question. I think we might need to give some more background on what we're talking about first, but I think we're going to answer this as we go, because I think the question is whether it's driving behavior or whether it's selecting for people who aren't insufferable. I think it's probably more of the latter, but it could be both. Yes. So Eddie, do you remember back into high school political, what do we call it? Social sciences? Was that what it's called? Is that middle school? I don't remember.
This is really going off the rails.
No, this is perfect. They change the name every year. They're like, oh, it's politics. No, it's social sciences.
Well, anyway. I remember in high school it was AP government.
Right. Okay. Then that makes sense, I suppose.
And yes, I was in AP classes in the high school. I want to bring that up, but yeah, there it is.
Eddie wrote this down in the thing. He was like, do a long, elaborate lead-in so I can mention AP government. I'm just following the script.
Yeah.
So the quick background is that a lot of people, I think, probably know about it as much as us, and that, you know, we can recite the numbers and we know how many people there, but I think most people just take it for granted that that was a set number. And that was apportioned over time. Maybe there was a little fudging here and there, but that is definitely not true. There were actually only 65 members in the House in the original Congress, and that was apportioned based on population. So with the estimated 13 states, 13 colonies, having about 3.7 million people, there was a representative for every 57,000 people at the beginning of our great nation. 57,000 people is a lot of people, but it's not a crazy amount of people. I was at a Liverpool game the other day, and it's less people than fit in the stadium that I was in. So you could feasibly get every one of your constituents together in an Anfield-sized stadium and speak to them about policy issues. How many people in the United States, the average congressman and congresswoman oversee today? What is your guess, Eddie, in looking directly at our notes, but I won't tell the listeners?
I'd say somewhere in the range north of 700,000.
Brilliant. Brilliant guess. 700,000 people is a F ton of people. That's a crazy amount of people. You can't fit them in any stadium in the world. And it's way too many people to be represented by a single person, even if that person were an angel. And the people we have representing those people right now are decidedly not angels. We've got terrible people looking over tons and tons of people. Then you might think, listeners out there thinking, okay, well, what's the problem for one? And you know, is there a better way? And I think,
Well,
yeah, give me some hit back at me, Eddie.
I just don't think these are terrible people. I think there's a reason all of them take on these terrible tendencies, right? It's not, there's no way that like, you know, the worst, they're all very, well, most of them are very intelligent, right? You kind of have to be to like worm your way into these seats of power. I think that, there's a reason why politicians won't give a straight answer to a straight question. I think there's a reason why politicians won't answer our emails. I think there's a reason why there's this kind of PR speak that politicians carry on. I think that there's a reason why, you know, politicians start out idealistic and then become so just compromised. And I think it's systemic. And I think, yeah, there's some shitheads in there too, but do you not agree? You think it's more there's a certain type of person that's attracted to this, and then they're just like narcissists or what?
I think that's definitely part of it. I think there are a lot of studies showing that the people attracted to politics are not representative of just ordinary people. There certainly are good people. There are also idealists who are drawn to politics. I think that's definitely also true. And I think the system makes it very difficult. So let me just give you an example that I think would back up your conception of this. Like, try to imagine you in a car with like five friends and you're driving past some of your favorite fast food places.
I can't imagine that. I don't have five friends and
Okay,
my car doesn't
three
hold that
friends.
amount. Okay. Yeah,
And
I
you can't
can.
afford
Yes.
fast food.
And I can't afford fast food.
I
Maybe
mean,
Jack in the Box, like
if
the
it
two
was, that's true, the
tacos
tacos,
for a dollar.
that's fair. If it was me and you, yeah, we're going to Taco Bell. Easy enough.
Yeah.
However, there's five friends. Imagine trying to get unanimity amongst all five friends on which place is the best to go.
If you're driving down a stretch and it has like Chick-fil-A, it has In-N-Out, it
Yeah, that's what I'm
has,
saying. Like
yeah.
suburban
Taco
America.
Bell, right?
Yeah. All right, now imagine there are five enemies, and these aren't even friends. These are just random people from the street. These are your neighbors. You got them all in the car, and they're trying to decide. One of them's a vegetarian. One of them's a Episcopalian. We don't know where they're going. We don't know what they're trying to do.
Yeah.
So now multiply that by whatever the division of five by 700,000 is, and that's how difficult it's going to be to try to get individual people's opinions represented in Congress. I just think it's infeasible to think that any one member can represent even the half of the district that voted for them, right? Which is not what they're supposed to do, but even so, it's
Yeah.
literally impossible, right? And so you might think, okay, but isn't representing 50,000 people just as difficult? I would argue it's not even close to as difficult. For one, it's a much tighter geographic space, right? So imagine your 50,000 people draw a circle around wherever you are right now. 50,000 people circle versus the 700,000 people circle are drastically different. They encompass far wider arrays of rural urban splits, and they're going to encompass a wider range of socioeconomic disparities, lots of different things that make it very difficult to balance the views of individual people on one side of your constituency with another side of your constituency. And there's been a
Right.
lot of work on this from local news, right? So one of the major reasons that people have pointed to for polarization in America is because of the nationalization of the news. Local news organizations can't survive anymore because reporting on a local issue doesn't financially make you money like reporting on national issues does. And so local organizations go under, and then nobody's there to cover local issues. I see the exact same trend in the split from 50,000 people to 700,000 people. If you have a small local school district problem, if you ran on fixing the schools in your area as a congressperson, it wouldn't matter as much if they were Republican or Democrat. They could point to specific things and be like, we're going to fix, the issues on the basketball courts. We're going to fix the issues with the principal. Instead, if you have 700,000 people and you're encompassing, 25 different districts, it's much harder to run on local issues. And it's much more likely that you're going to have to say, well, I support sort of the Democratic or Republican platform, or I sort of support Trump or Biden, right? And I think these are massive issues that result basically from the fact that you have to cater to such a large group of people.
Yeah, it kind of dilutes any sort of stance and doesn't make anybody happy. It's like the worst type of compromise where nobody gets what they want and nobody's happy. And so you can't even please like a minority opinion, never. I guess the counter argument would be that if you're representing 700,000 people, you're representing every type of American. And so you have to consider every type of American, in your district as you're voting and as you're casting these votes and, as you're putting your campaign and platform together. I think that it's kind of a volume problem in the sense that that type of person becomes faceless and it becomes easier, I think, to just, I don't know, make an abstraction out of those groups of people in 700,000, where it's a lot harder to do that, like you're saying, when the sample size is 50,000, and 50,000, you're probably still representing at least, I don't know, the people who need to be, I don't know, heard in a way that can't possibly be heard when they're one of 700K.
I think you're absolutely right. I think one of the things, so we haven't even discussed how we got from the 60 people to the 435 people, and why it stopped. But I think one of the Pew Research Center article that you put in the doc, like a very dutiful co-host, by Drew DeSilver, has some pretty shocking graphs. And I'm gonna do what every podcast listener loves and explain a graph that is a visual. Which we will hopefully put it in the podcast notes, but
That's what I
I
love.
essentially just picture an exponential graph. That's all you need to picture in your mind. The fact is that it has not, as if we've steadily grown from 50,000 people apportionments to the 700, nearly 750,000 people allotments that we have today. But it was at less than 200,000 into the last century. Around 1910, it was still only 193,000 people
Well,
per
yeah.
district, which is still a
And
lot.
I don't know if we mentioned that the first Congress had 65 House members, and so that there's no constitutional basis for the number. In other words,
Yeah, there's,
65 was just a holdover until they had a first census of the new nation,
and they were literally constrained by the size of the house, which is still something that people bring up as a counter argument that the government should be run poorly because we can't hire contractors, which is just a ridiculous argument.
Hey, but on the other hand, have you tried to hire a contractor before? It's hard.
That's, we need a FDR style investment system
Yeah.
to extend the bidding process. Anyway, in about 1920, they started to discuss reapportionment and the expansion of the state because they were running out of seats in the House. And probably more likely, people point to the fact that rural populations and rural states thought that they were maybe having their share and their voice diluted by the increasing number of members in the House. And so in 1930 or 1929, they came together and passed a law capping the size of the House at 435 arbitrarily, because at the time they were saying, hey, this is getting too big. There's too many of us. Let's slow this down. And we haven't changed it since. Actually, it's not technically true. They added two seats when Alaska and Hawaii joined, and then they took those two away for an unknown reason because those two people must have been real a-holes. And so we've capped it, and it has not changed in the subsequent 100 years. So, if you're catching this correctly, the House grew about 100 seats per century for the first 200 years and then stopped growing completely in 1930. And they haven't changed it since, and nobody has gone back and thought that this might not be the exact perfect number for the representation of America, even though America has nearly tripled in size since then.
And I mean, we can get into why some of the reasons why it's not increasing, but basically, I mean, I think that there's a certain amount of Republicans that just assume that if we expand the House even further, those expansion is going to happen into urban, densely populated areas that are going to vote Democrat. And so they're kind of disincentivized to try to increase it, even though it would be better for the country. And then also, I'm sure Democratic candidates and current congressmen and women who are Democrats don't want to expand it also because it's easier to keep their jobs and not be primaried and not have, other representatives
in their district that they have to work with and deal with and, you know, share their power with.
The thing is, you would have more districts. So you wouldn't actually have to, if anything, I think you would have a better chance of getting reelected as long as you could, you know, cater to local populations. It would, what it would do is it would make you have to actually listen to the views of your constituents, which maybe that's what they hate. So
yeah, well, or I think there's another model, right? If they do like ranked choice voting, but keep the same districts and have more members, then that's where that would come into play. This kind of like coalition, right?
Even then you would still keep your job, right? If anything, there's always more jobs.
Right.
This is creating more jobs no matter what. Maybe you wouldn't be the top dog in your district, but you would still have a job. And they love that. The Congress people love jobs. Let me tell you. There's nothing they love.
Especially
more than
theirs.
Jobs. That's what I'm saying.
They I'm love gonna make
their jobs first.
I'm gonna say something crazy, and it might be controversial. Congressmen love their jobs even more than your jobs.
I think. Do you think if we changed the system so that there was more jobs, they would just be like, wow, jobs in America go through the roof? Maybe this is why they're all pissed about jobs all the time. They're like, it hasn't changed in years. The stagnation is crazy.
Yep.
I think that's exactly why. One of the other kind of profound things that comes out of this article is the idea that, you know, maybe this is just the, you know, the globe is getting bigger. There's just more people. Maybe it's population just can't keep up with the number of congressional representatives we need to have. However, we can compare this to the other OECD members to see whether the US is 750,000 people per constituency, per congressional representative.
Well, Morgan, for our listeners, for our listeners out there, what is OECD?
It's the basically the group of wealthy developed countries that we compare ourselves to on a, you know, a number of economic and political metrics. It's most of the countries that people would refer to as like the West in everyone's mind. But from those countries, Eddie,
Ireland.
Yes, Ireland is in there. Good call.
UK. Yes, Netherlands. Indeed. Germany.
Indeed, all of the above. Basically, Canada. All of it. It's essentially Europe and the US and Canada.
Mexico.
Yes.
South Korea.
Indeed.
Japan. Is Australia even in there?
They are. They are indeed.
Wow. Even Turkey.
So you have to flip it upside down, though, the OECD. So it's DECO, but the rest is the same.
Okay. You're not talking to our editor about kind of snipping that portion. Keep everything.
Snip it, but make it extra long, like double the size. Okay, so Eddie, when we're looking at this map, which is drawn to the size of the number of individuals per representative, is the U.S. towards the middle of this group? He's shaking his head.
No, it is not. Podcast
listeners out there.
I was shaking my head for when we eventually do video pods.
Yeah.
No, it is not anywhere even close to the middle. It's what about triple the the next country?
Yeah, that's the thing. It's not even close. The next closest, so not just the average, but the next closest is Japan, which has 272,000 per, which again is much closer to when we stopped expanding the seats to match the population. So if we had continued to expand at the same rate, we would have one around Japan, somewhere in between Japan and South Korea. However, if you look at most kind of Western European countries, basically any European country, the kind of median is much closer to about 22,000. So think about that. Think about 22,000 versus 750,000 and how differently your congressional representative would act if they just had to represent the views of 22,000 people. So let's talk about this practically, Eddie.
22,000 is like the population of Rio Grande.
That's like how many listens we get on each of our podcasts.
I know. No, but it's like, think about being the mayor of Rio Grande and how many people come into town halls and complain about the most mundane, inane crap. And could you imagine how much healthier it would be if you could subject your Congress representative to your own concerns to that degree, right?
That's the thing. So I think this is where we can talk about some of our like personal examples. So the one thing that always stood out to me is when I was doing some work in the UK on campaigns, the UK is not even towards the bottom. It's somewhere in the middle of the European ratios. So it's about, I think it's about 90,000. But even 90,000 to one candidates actually go door to door and campaign. They listen to people. They have, they're required to be in their constituencies at least one day a week to meet with people from the community, because people can come in and you can actually set aside meetings with individual people from your community at that size.
Yeah.
You cannot do that with 750,000 people. It's too many damn people. So you don't even go, campaigning is not based on door-to-door campaigns. You never actually meet the voters. You have a group of people phone calling all the time. And now our phones are blowing up with spam messages, and congressmen get all their information about what people think from Twitter. And that's how we end up where we are today.
Yeah. And also, I don't know, right now, we're in the lead up to, I mean, the primaries for like everything. And I'm getting all these propaganda from, you know, mayoral candidates and council member candidates. And it's, you know, and then I read in my local newspaper, supporting local journalism, of which I'm a subscriber to two, Voice of San Diego and San Diego Union Tribune. Shout out. And, you know, come to find out in Voice of San Diego that there's basically Democratic mayoral candidates who are buying advertisements and flyers for their Republican rivals, touting how Republican they are and all these things and how they're representing, and sending them out to constituents because they want a runoff election with a Republican rather than with a fellow Democrat, because the polling is like, well, if it's a Republican in runoff, we'll definitely win. If it's a fellow Democrat, it might be, you know, sketchier. So we're going to spend our campaign dollars on, you know, whatever PAC is like doing this on their behalf, on actually touting and trying to get this Republican into the runoff. Like, it's gaming the system, and it's like nefarious in a way. It's, I don't know.
Well, think about it. So I think it's a great point. I mean, I think, let's imagine you're, you know, God forbid, you're a politician that's representing a constituency of 70.
Well, and I'm saying, I know I was saying like a mayoral example, but this will happen with Congress members, of course, I imagine as well. So
yeah. And so let's imagine you're, you know, representing your area. A lot of times throughout kind of the history of the U.S., at the very least, when things were less polarized, most of the information that you gain from your citizens is from elections, right? If people vote overwhelmingly against you in a certain point in time, or you see your poll numbers fall, you're going to think, okay, that's a bad policy. People don't actually think this. Or you're going to learn things directly from the people, right? Letters to congresspeople used to be much more common and read more widely. You could, you know, phone your congressional office. You can still do these things, but the chances of it making a difference or actually reaching the person are far less likely. And so what do? You have to turn to things like social media, which are not only distorted, but are distorted in specific ways, which lead to, you know, the most vitriolic type of language and, you know, the most elitist types of speech. And that's where you're getting your feedback mechanisms for your policies. So you're not only just going in blind, you're going in based on biased information that is distorted because people are voting on national issues, because you can't actually campaign on local issues.
And I think some of the vitriol is coming from like exasperation, because you can't like get a hold of this person that's supposed to represent you, you know, in the halls of power.
Yeah,
at least that's absolutely been my experience.
Imagine if we sang in Rio Grande, but of course we have listeners from all over the world, so people might not know what that is. But imagine that your local neighborhood or town had a congressional official who was there every week. You could set up a meeting and go talk to them about actual American policy and their votes in Congress. I think healthier democracy.
Can you explain in more in depth what Rio Grande is for our Burundi listeners?
Well, if you're picturing Burundi, just imagine it's like the capital. You know, picture some of the spaces between. It's a small town. It means big ditch in Spanish. I would say it's peri-urban in the words of Burundians and Afrobarometer. You know, we've got
very good, very good.
Yeah.
When I was in the UK, here's my UK anecdote. And I was teaching a creative writing class at Swansea University.
Hey, you were teaching a class, dude?
I was teaching a class.
750,000.
And one of my students mentioned how she emailed her member of parliament, her MP, and the MP or a staffer in the MP's office, I can't remember which, emailed her back a specific response to a specific question. And I was like, what? I was nonplussed. I couldn't believe it. And it just, you know, made me consider how that is such a better system. And I hadn't thought about it at the time, but I think it's just a volume problem, you know. And ours are, and you know, if you talk to these Congress members and you talk to their staffers, they'll probably defend themselves by saying, like, how could we possibly, you know, here's the amount of emails we get a day, here's the amount of calls we get a day, how could we possibly respond to all this? We'd have to have, you know, a staff of, you know, 30 to 45 to even do this. And it's like, well, maybe we need to make it easier on you guys by having more of you, you know.
Absolutely. I mean, it's, so I think from a academic perspective, I've thought about this question before and wanted to show with like data that polarization is tied to this question. So, you know, our formulation, if you had fewer members per constituent, you would be less polarized and perhaps less partisan. That's what I believe. However, because it's been capped for so long, it's very difficult to say what the counterfactual would be at the congressional level. And so what I've been trying to find is local ordinances where there's been some sort of shift or some sort of policy change into state legislatures, where it's gone from a small number to a large number. So this is a listener call. Yeah.
Yeah, because we don't have any model at the national level, so we'll do it at the state level where the amount of delegates has changed in the state government for the state.
Yes, state governments have different policies on how many representatives they want. Yeah. They can set it themselves. Yeah, yeah. So some states have very few, and it's very much matches the congressional model, and some states have a ton. And so, you know, my theory is that at least at the state level, we might be able to see, you know, some of these actual effects. I mean, you can see this. I think you could easily do some sort of cross-national study and show that individuals have more contact with their, you know, their representative in countries with fewer people per politician. But I don't know if that would be convincing enough to get the government to change its national policy. So if anyone out there is interested, I would love to run this study, so that we can bring, you know, bring me and Eddie. This is all an elaborate ploy to get me and Eddie elected in our own constituencies.
It would be fascinating to primary. Scott Peters is the name of my Democratic elected. Well, everyone's democratically elected. He is a Democrat.
Oh, are they, Eddie? You haven't been on the web.
Okay. So he's the representative for my district in San Diego. And I was looking at if anybody's primarying him for the election, if anybody's on the ballot, you know, for November. And I found that there was one guy, a fellow Democrat, you know, running against him and primarying him. And I looked on his website and it's like, this guy's got no chance. It's like horribly designed website. It doesn't in any way even like describe his platform. Like clearly not a serious candidate and not in any way going to give him a serious like push at all. And then this frustrated me because I wanted to vote for a Democratic candidate who was not Scott Peters, because I feel like all of the emails I've been sending him in protest to how, you know, the House of Representatives, many Democrats in the House of Reps are not sufficiently taking seriously the civilian casualty and specifically like the deaths of children that this Israel-Hamas war is perpetrating, and still just voting to send billions of dollars to Israel, to the war machine currently there. And so I've been sending him email after email, just, you know, recounting this death toll of children, and nobody's from his office, and certainly not him, is ever emailing me back, other than this one initial boilerplate, you know, basically a press release statement about how Israel has a right to defend itself. And, you know, we're shocked and horrified by the Palestinian civilian casualties, and we need a better solution. And just kind of the Biden stance of like, yeah, you know, they shouldn't be this aggressive, but here's billions of dollars more with no strings attached, you know? So that frustrated me. And then as, you know, a taxpayer who wants to be a better representative, I want somebody that, you know, on this issue and others, is going to be more humanitarian. And there's just, I have no options because the Republican candidate is more than likely going to be even more pro-Israel and more. And so it's like this idea that I'm becoming more disenchanted with the this democratic process and becoming less invested in local politics and less, I don't know, it's making me more disaffected. And then it's just causing this problem where less and less people are going to pay attention. So worse and worse people are going to get nominated to these halls of power, and then things are going to go even worse. So it's like, it's I think a structural problem that this could be one piece of fixing, you know?
Well, Eddie, do you know who the Democratic candidate was for the 3rd congressional district in South Carolina, where I live, in 2022?
this is what I want to ask you, is like, how disaffected are you? No, who, what is the person's name, and who, so what is their chances?
The number two candidate, so this was in 2022, just in the last one, was write-in, because they did not run a Democratic candidate.
There was no Democratic candidate at all.
Write-in was number two. Yep.
Even was there a certain name that got the most write-ins?
Just write-in. Nope. No name.
Okay. Wow. Okay. So no chance. So how? What percentage of the vote did the Republican win of?
97.6%.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
That's obviously a huge problem. What also is a huge problem is that according to Ballotpedia,
they have a stupid name, but they actually have really good data. So
yeah, and that's they seem to be the authorities in this field. The percent that incumbents win in the state of California is 89%, and that's on the low end. Most states are higher than 89% incumbents winning. I think that would be all incumbents across state legislative and federal legislative. And it's terrifying because it's just almost guaranteed job security. And so
just think of 10 politicians. There's no way 9 of those guys should be reelected. If anything, it should be the other way around, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so it's another, I feel like, reason why there needs to be more competition. There needs to be more people in these races, or there needs to be more like coalition building within these districts. If it's ranked choice voting, if I could vote for Scott Peters, but I could also vote for somebody else that has a, you know, at least a shot at getting, you know, representing a different constituency within my district that has a different set of priorities, whether it's a Green Party candidate or whatever, you know.
Absolutely. And I think one of the bigger things too is the House has gotten extremely polarized in its voting, right? It's rather rare nowadays for the House to like break from House leadership on specific votes. And when it does happen, it makes the news. You know, it's hard to corral 200 people from your party to vote the same way, but they've gotten better at it. You know, what's really hard is to corral 500 people from your party that are all from much smaller and more representative districts, right? So it not only would make it more difficult for parties to corral the national vote and to, you know, continue gridlock to help future election chances, but it would also make it more representative at the local level. So Eddie, let's shift over to the solution side. How many Congress members do you think there should be in the U.S. House of Congress, the U.S. House?
I believe, and I'll quote the article here, in the show notes, but I believe a good number would be north of like 1,100. If we did it more proportionally and more, you know, in keeping with the size of this country and like a more representative proportion for representing that populace.
Yeah, that's if we hadn't made the stupid rule in 1930 and we weren't worried about the size of the House and the actual number of seats and we had kept expanding it proportionally based on the Constitution. Who can argue with the Constitution? Everyone loves the Constitution. Massively high approval rating.
Yeah, none more than you.
Freaking love that thing.
Your wife, Nompi, sent me a photo of your new bedspread and it was just the U.S. Constitution all printed out.
Yeah, it's actually all the sheets. Each sheet is a different page.
It's a different page.
Exactly.
Right, yeah. It's cold in South Carolina, so you need all those sheets.
Exactly. Just rub up on me with the Second Amendment, dude. I'm all about it.
Especially the Second Amendment, you print it out multiple times because that's how much you're supported.
Yeah. Actually, the only one I don't have is in there is like the shit, I'm gonna mess it up. Is it the fourth one? But because I actually I'm down. If people in the military want to come house, they can get under my constitutional sheets. That's not a problem.
Yep.
Some good constitution jokes in here.
How many elected representatives do you think should be?
I thought you meant how many military members should come to my house later. I think, I think the 1100 number is, it would be a good start. I think personally, my goal for this podcast, obviously, to change US policy, this is just to get the ball rolling. I think if we could change it at all, just to remind people that it's not a fixed number. I think people now are just like, oh, it's 435. That's just what it is. I think we just need some sort of change to show that we can change it, and then people will be more likely to move it in the future. And so I actually am in support of the Wyoming rule, which I think is a very dumb rule, but I think would get the point across that we've changed it. We can at least change it a little bit. And so, Eddie, what is the Wyoming rule? Just one sentence, this proposal. If you don't have it, I can pull it up.
Well, it's basically the smallest ratio between the size of a single state and the representative that represents, you know, that state, which is, I think in this case, a one district state, right, in Wyoming, is the state of Wyoming. It's about 450,000, right, per representative. Is that correct?
Actually, the Wyoming rule is that you have to wear cowboy boots to weddings. No, that's correct, Eddie. I think this is basically bringing the house to about 535. So it would like add 100 people to the house. I think this is relatively wouldn't solve a ton of problems, but it would at least show people that we can change it. And I think it would reduce some of the strain that we've had. I think the difference between 400 and 500 is, you know, a 20% increase, which is actually quite a lot, even if it's not the 1,000 person house that I would actually like in the long run.
Yeah, I think, well, and according to this Pew study, it would be, 1,156 to be like proportional since the 1930s census. I feel like based on some of the extensive research that we did, we'll link to some of the articles that we looked at in preparation for this episode. This could be a bipartisan issue. This can be something that we all can get behind. Like,
I agree.
There's this NPR article that quotes a former Republican representative, Tom Campbell of California, citing how, quote, no one looks at the House of Representatives today and says, there's a good model of functioning governance. No one says that. And so the interest in trying something has never been higher, says Campbell, who's now a law professor, blah, blah, blah. Trying to make, you know, a Republican case for fixing it and having, basically citing how in so many districts across our nation, you know, this is Campbell again, quote, a Republican puts her name or his name on such a bill, be targeted in the next primary election for the simple reason you're attempting to move towards a system that might allow more members of Congress who are not Republican. But also there's a lot of districts that Republicans have no voice, right? There's always a Democratic candidate representing them. It's the inverse of the district that you're in, right, Morgan, where there's a 97% voting for a Democrat, and that Republican who's in that district just has no, well, they do have representation technically, but not with somebody that's more reflective of their worldview and their values. It's like if you're a Republican voter in the state of California voting for president, your entire life, your vote means nothing. Absolutely nothing.
That's how we like it.
No, it's just funny to me that like people still defend the Electoral College when in states where, you know, they'll knowingly choose their vote to mean absolutely nothing if it means that they can like gamify the system so that they're candidate can win less votes and win the presidency. Like, that's silly to me, but what are you gonna do?
It is ridiculous. So Eddie, if you are talking to our listeners, what I would say is go out there and tell somebody about this. Say, hey, I think we should have more politicians. Don't elaborate. Just walk away. Because that's what we want you to take away from this, is that we think there should be more politicians in the United States, specifically the House, which, as you mentioned, has one of the lowest approval ratings of any congressional, of anybody, of any, basically any profession in the United States. And our counterintuitive example, which if you listen through, I think is pretty solid, is that we think there should be more of them, and that will make them suck less. So returning to your example really quickly, Eddie, now that we've talked through it, and listeners, think about this at home. If you're looking, you're with, if you're with your friends on your way through a suburban area and you're trying to decide on a restaurant, wait, pause for a second before you get into that, that argument and think to yourself, do you think that it's the politicians that are being strained by this system to do bad things? Or do you think the system itself is recruiting bad people to do bad things? What do you think, Eddie? Are you still where you were before? You think these are good people made to do bad things like RoboCop? Or do you think these are bad people who are allowed to do bad things?
No, I mean, I think that just...
Like the Terminator.
I think that if you take 10 highly intelligent people and run them through a system of campaigning and election and governing, and like... 8 out of those 10 people suck. For me, that is not a self-selective bias. That is, there's something in that system that is flawed, that is bringing out the worst in these 8 people. And so I do think it's a systemic thing rather than it drawing a specific subpopulation that is craven, power hungry, you know, whatever, egotistical, whatever, like a negative characteristic you want to ascribe to them.
That's fair. I think it's like the serum in Captain America, where like these are the reason why it worked in Captain America for your listeners out there is because he was a good man. That's the point of the first movie. But I think it's basically like if we took a bunch of people who kind of sucked already, and then we just sucked all the life out of them, we made them suck even worse. That is the current system of government. And so what I'm asking is just let them be normally sucky, just average sucky people instead of sociopathic sucky people who don't have to respond to their constituents.
Or it's like, if they're going to be the same amount of suckiness, at least like let some good old fashioned, you know, capitalistic, you know, competition makes better product.
Yeah, it's a free let it be a free market.
Yeah, some laissez-faire-ness, you know?
Let the customers decide. I agree.
I just want more input and I want more options.
You know what's likely to happen? You have more districts, even if we're not doing PR, you're much more likely to get third parties. People love third parties. So we can tie back to that. I think in the future, Eddie, we should have a couple of these episodes where we talk about ways to fix the U.S. government. One of the ones that I was going to bring up today, but I think it could be its own episode, or at least the start of another episode, is about the idea that people can have multiple votes, but they get to apportion them on issues they find very important or less important. So if you really care about education, you could spend 8 of your 10 votes on an education policy. But we'll talk about this next time. That's a preview for all you subscribers out there. Until next time, rational listeners, we're out.
Adios. Thank you.